This is the John Clayton Show.
Brought to you by Coors Light, the world's most refreshing beer.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Joining us right now, Greg Bell from the Tacoma News Tribune. So, Greg, have you made it to Detroit yet?
I'm actually in Ohio visiting my family, John, right west of Pittsburgh. Steubenville, Ohio. You might remember where that is.
Oh, of course I know Steubenville. How about that?
Rainy, cold, very Midwest here. Luckily,
I've been through that before. You become quite the traveler now. I mean, the extra time in London and now Steubenville, Ohio. I mean, boy, you're moving around.
I am. Flew into Cleveland, drove down here. My parents still live here. This is where I was born and raised and went to high school. And it's pretty much different. But, you know, the Steel Valley's not quite like it used to be.
No, it is different. There's no question about that. So it's kind of interesting, you know, because you look at the schedule coming up for Seattle, and it's very similar for Detroit because they've got about five games against franchise-type quarterbacks, and you know, because the North is NFC North is playing the NFC or West. I mean, there's a lot of parallels. Now, again, they got a Chicago game in there, but this is a tough schedule coming up right now for the Detroit Lions.
It is. These two teams, John, more than any I can remember of a Seahawks opponent, mirror each other both in how they got to where they are, they're playing each other tomorrow, and where they go. They both started 0-2, as you know. They both won three out of their last four by returning to the run and giving their quarterback a chance, an option, and a dimension that their offenses haven't had. I mean, Matthew Stafford, the last three times the Seahawks have faced the Lions, the Seahawks just go after the quarterback as the way to win the game, and now you got to defend Kerryon Johnson in a running game that got 248 yards against Miami last week. And then, as you mentioned, who the Lions have next, the Seahawks, they got to go against Aaron Rodgers and Jared Goff. And the next five-game stretch, Phillip Rivers next week in Seattle, very defining stretch for this team. I think, John, the K.J. Wright's return tomorrow is really going to help the defense become whole and itself for the first time this year, how they want to be, and that is playing a little more base 3-4-3 defense. They've been a nickel 85% of the time the last 2 weeks, and I know the Rams will put you in nickel a lot because of 11 personnel, but the Raiders not so much, and they still played nickel to just have two linebackers on the field after Michael Kendricks got suspended and Wright was still out at weak side. So I think they're more equipped defensively to handle a more balanced Detroit offense than they're used to, but it's not only tomorrow, but the next 5 weeks that they're going to have to deal with.
Yeah. And how do you think, I mean, the secondary, because again, in some cases, they didn't take on the greatest quarterbacks in the first six games. I mean, they had a couple, but, I mean, you know, is the expectation they can contain a Stafford and some of these quarterbacks to 250 yards, or is it going to be the 300-yard efforts by some of these quarterbacks?
Well, they may have to endure some 300-yard efforts and still win the game. And there may be some games like a Phillip Rivers-type game or Cam Newton in Carolina in a month that Russell Wilson's going to have to make plays in the fourth quarter and outgun somebody. But in the case of the Lions tomorrow, they really believe the first step will be to take away Kerryon Johnson in the run and then make it a more familiar defending the Lions game, and that is go after the quarterback and Matthew Stafford. Now, the Lions are as good as anyone in the league at protecting their quarterback and giving them time to throw. Stafford gets the ball out quickly, and it's been helped because they've had a running game this year. But if they can take away the run, Kerryon Johnson and LeGarrette Blount with more base defense early in games and early downs in series, look for Frank Clark to have a really big game and help out that nickel defense and the extra defensive backs and secondary. And that's really been the surprise of the year to me, John, is the effectiveness of the pass rush. It's sometimes been Frank Clark single-handedly taking what I thought was the weakest part of this team, pass rush, and making it a factor. Now, the offensive line for Oakland was a mess, and two starting rookie tackles that Frank Clark abused. The Lions will be better offensively up front. The Chargers will be better offensively up front next week. It's a much tougher test for both the pass rush and thus the Seattle secondary here the next few weeks.
Yeah, no question. The what kind of thing, the interesting part about the tomorrow is going to be how they sort out the roster, because first they have to make the decision today on Ed Dixon, whether they get who moves from him. And you would have to venture to think it's probably going to be Tyrone Swopes getting cut. Would you agree with that?
Right. I would think so, especially because both Nick Vinette's back from his back injury that cost him the London game. So now they have their two top tight ends back for the first time.
But the other interesting one is now with the Deion Jordan healthy and Rasheem Green coming back healthy. You know, who's now going to be the inactive defensive lineman? Does that still stay Naz Jones, or how do you think they sort that out at defensive end? Because now, at least with the addition of Jordan now back, they have a lot of options at defensive end.
They do. Early in the season, it was Puna Ford, the undrafted rookie, was being inactive, but Ford has often passed Jones in the defensive line rotation, defensive tackle rotation, and I wouldn't be surprised if Naz Jones is inactive tomorrow because they want to keep Puna Ford in for run stopping against a Lion team that wants to run more. Jones has so far in his couple years proven to be more of a pass rusher, long guy, knocking down balls at the line of scrimmage than he has a run stopper. Puna Ford, the squat, fire plug built, strong, 300-plus pound short guy, you would think would be more of a run defender inside. So I think one of the last active roster spots will go to Puna Ford, and that'll leave, at my guess, Naz Jones inactive.
Yeah, that would make, I think, a lot of sense. But how do you think they're going to have that rotation at defensive end? Because now this is the first time that in the front seven they have a full implement of players.
They do. Quentin Jefferson has been starting because Deion Jordan's knee just has not been consistently well enough to play. I'm not convinced Jordan's going to be a 30, 40, 50 snap guy tomorrow, so Jefferson will still alternate in there with Frank Clark on the other side. Rasheem Green is officially listed as questionable, but the way Pete Carroll talked yesterday, it sounds like he's going to play after three games out, 4 weeks with a high ankle sprain. And if Green and Jordan are in there, then Quentin Jefferson goes down the pecking list at defensive end, and he becomes more of a situational spot guy. They still like to go, John, as you know, 8-9 deep in the first quarter on the defensive line if it's working right. They just haven't had the bodies and health in Jordan and Green the last month to do that. Tomorrow might be the first time that they can go as deep on the defensive line, which is right in time for a team like Detroit that wants to run the ball.
And of course, and that's right at the time too when they have, you know, the tough part of their schedule coming up here, you know, 5 weeks of tough football that they really. Well, I mean, I know Brock Hewitt was thinking, you know, they more than likely can go 2-3 in this stretch. I think it's important for them to go 3-2 just because you want to come out of this with a 6-5 record, and then you start getting home games and the easy part of your schedule.
Exactly, and. You know, normally you say, well, if you take care of your home games, they have six home games remaining. If you take care of your home games and you win a couple on the road, you get the 10 wins in the playoffs. The problem with yes, they have four of their final five at home, the Seahawks do, but two of those four games are against the Chiefs and the Vikings. And you can't count those as, like, just because they're being played in Seattle, they're going to win. Nobody's stopping the Chiefs right now, and Patrick Mahomes and Tyreek Hill and that offense. You have to assume that between the Chiefs and the Vikings games that they're likely to lose one of those games. So now you got to go get a win on the road to make up for that. To get to 10 wins, this game tomorrow could ultimately be very pivotal. And, John, I've been saying this for a little bit now. I think ultimately in December, the Seahawks, Brian Schottenheimer and Pete Carroll are going to regret not running the ball with Chris Carson more in Denver and Chicago to begin the season. And that may be the one win that they need at the end of the year that they don't get. If they don't make the playoffs, they're going to be remembering September 9th in Denver.
Yeah. See, I agree with that because I thought that was one that was they should have had a split on the road, and I think that they just kind of slipped through these games. I mean, they didn't have enough challenge, I think, from Mitch Trubisky, particularly after the first quarter, and so that was there to be had. And then, of course, they did run Penny a little bit in the second half of that game. But you're right. I mean, that Denver game was one that they really should have won. Now that we see what the Denver Broncos really are,
right. They're one of the worst run defenses in the league. Von Miller, yes, he's still a great pass rusher. They can still get after the quarterback. But Seattle played right into Denver's hands by not running the ball and letting Von Miller and Chubb tee off on the edge and sack Russell Wilson six times. If they run 20, 25 times, even if for 2.8 yards per carry like they ran against the Cowboys, they don't lose that game. They would possess the ball more. Russell Wilson wouldn't have taken the sacks that caused 3rd-and-12s and 3rd-and-16s. I think they win that game. They can definitely get a score and not give up one more score to win what became a 3-point loss just by running the ball more. simply to do it. And Chris Carson only had 7 carries that day. They obviously have figured out that's not the way to play offense for the way this team's built. You look at all the metrics and the Pro Football Focus and everything, John, that say that Seattle's better pass rushing and one of the best pass protection teams in the league. My theory, and I truly believe this, is that they didn't suddenly become good at pass blocking. They've been bad at it for about 3 years. It's that they're doing less of it now because they're running the ball more. So they're doing less of what they're worst at. And that has made all the difference for Russell Wilson and the offense's effectiveness. Instead of 3rd-and-12 and 3rd-and-10 and 3rd-and-8, it's now 3rd-and-2 or 3. And if you do pass the ball at 3rd-and-3, you're going to be a lot more effective in play action, in faking the run, and having the threat of the run. Jermaine Ifedi and Dwayne Brown have both told me the last couple of weeks that the biggest difference for edge rushers they've had to block the last month is that those edge blockers have had to stop and think and hesitate and read run block versus pass block to start plays. And in Chicago and Denver to start the season, Von Miller and Khalil Mack weren't reading anything. They were doing just like the edge rushers against Seattle did last year, which is take off with their ears pinned back after the quarterback at the snap without any regard to a threat of the run. And you can't sustain pass protection, especially the way the Seahawks are constructed on the offensive line, doing that. Not to mention the addition of DJ Fluker at right guard, exactly down the type of blocker that they want to play offense like, which is a man-on-man, downhill, road grader type of run blocker, has always had trouble in his career with the Chargers and the Giants in pass protection, but not in run blocking. It's fit to him perfectly with this offense to run the ball more. I really think that the biggest difference, why Russell Wilson's not getting sacked, why the pass protection numbers are so good, and why the offense is producing in the red zone and on third down, is simply because the defenses have to now honor the run and be a more balanced, honest defense against Seattle.
Well, that's the one thing, because I mean, there were so many things that Brian Schottenheimer was getting criticized for that I just I say, no, that's not the case. Like, for example, they said, you know, they're not being creative enough and they're not doing enough run pass option. And of course, what they're thinking of is like Russell Wilson's not running the football. ESPN Stats and Info put out the stat this week that the leading team for yards on RPO, run pass option, for rushing, the Seahawks. 300 yards, and I think the number two team is Carolina at about 284, and there's no other team that's 200. And with the run-pass option for the runs, they're getting 5.7 yards per carry, which if it's the best in the league, I guess, is that not creative? It's effective, whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people want Russell Wilson to just throw the ball over the yard and think that their offense is not dynamic enough because Wilson's not running enough. Well, we've seen that for 2 years. We saw it last year. That's why Daryl Bevel doesn't have a job in Seattle anymore. He relied completely on Russell Wilson doing everything. They had no running game to support him. RPO last year in the first two games of this year was just PO for the Seahawks. Pass option. There was no run. Mm-hmm. There was no run to respect. And so obviously their effectiveness is going to be better in run pass options if you can run the ball enough to make it a threat. And now you've had three consecutive 100-yard backs, and they hadn't had that since Marshawn Lynch in 2012. It's just a completely different way to defend the Seahawks, to game plan for them, to tell your defensive players all week that you have to honor the run, that you have to read your run keys before you rush the quarterback. That's all back to 2013 and 14 that the Seahawks hadn't had for 2 or 3 years since then. And it completely changes the mentality of an edge pass rusher when he's been told all week he's got to read the tackle, whether he's going to run or pass block, and whether he's got to find the tailback to see if he's coming off tackle or around the edge before you go get Russell Wilson. That completely changes how teams defend Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's going to be a fun game tomorrow to kind of see, and really a fun stretch right now for the next five to see where this team really is. And, of course, I guess the one big thing for Seattle, they're healthy, and you look at Detroit, they're healthy. I guess the final thought is, how effective do you think Damon Harrison is going to be in his debut game for the Lions?
I think they're going to plug him in, and he'll be right in the middle of it. I don't expect there to be any ramp-up or breaking-in period. A run-stopping defensive tackle, he can do that in any league, in any setting, indoor or outdoor, whatever color uniform he's wearing. Stop, plug your gap, tie up your linemen and responsibilities, and go find the running back. You can do that without even knowing what the playbook is for Detroit. So I think Snacks is going to be a big factor tomorrow. One that the Seahawks didn't think they had to block, when they played the Giants last season, that was one of the keys to beating the Giants is taking care of him in the middle. That's going to be a day for the center of the Seahawks offense is to control him. Whether Ansa plays on the outside, he's listed as questionable, is another factor for Detroit in the pass rush. He's been hurt most of this season. But it starts with the run and Harrison against what the Seahawks want to do again offensively. Expect the Seahawks to start with the run and pound Chris Carson early to set up the play action pass just like they did in London and just like they had success doing against the Rams before that. And Harrison's going to be right in the middle of defending that.
Okay. Well, Greg Bell, News Tribune, thank you for joining us. Enjoy yourself in Steubenville, and I'll see you tomorrow in Detroit.
Yes, you will. Thank you, John.
Okay, that's Greg Bell, Tacoma News Tribune. Give us a call at 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, more John Clayton on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Steve in Burien. Hey, Steve.
Hey, John. First off, go Cougs.
There you go.
Yep. All the way.
Going to win the Pac-12. Going to take it all. But a question. When is technology going to step up in football and they're going to get rid of the 10-yard change in the measuring crew? I've been seeing it for years. Is all you got to do is put a sensor at both ends of the football, put readers across the goal lines, sidelines, and then, you know, you have a 10-yard thing. So every time the ball crosses, breaks the laser, light goes off, you have an instant first down. You don't have to waste time measuring, bring the guys with the chains in and having to pull it to see if it's, you know, reached or not. And you can also, it will also eliminate having to review touchdowns too, because so that sensor reads that laser line, boom, light goes off, touchdown instantly. Other than having,
yeah, so here's the one problem with that is that that sensor is going to pick up the first time you cross the line, but what if the ball or the legs aren't totally over? So in other words, you still have to make the judgment call of where the legs are down, and so what you're going to be getting the head, the shoulder, the arm, that's going to cross first, but you don't know where the legs are going to be. That's where the judgment has to be as far as the placement of the ball.
Okay, but isn't it about just where the ball is?
Yeah, because that's not necessarily the case. It's like you still have to, you can have the ball, because, you know, like, for example, and this is, again, maybe one of the crazy rules that they have, is that, if a runner is going across, then he goes across the line and he has that go from the goal line to infinity. But if it's a receiver making a catch, I mean, he doesn't have that right, because he still has to show, has he caught, where's his feet, all those different things. So you still have that judgment that has to be there where the foot hits the ground first, or the knee hits the ground first. That's where that's you have to have that judgment, and that would kind of overrule and not really give you enough information to make the right decision.
You think it's going to happen eventually, though? Does that mean a sensor in the football, and you know, with the electronics they got now, it should be able to, you know, just like with hockey, the minute the puck crosses the line, you know, lights go off. I'm just thinking it's.
Yeah, but see, where the issue with that is that it's not just the puck, it's the football in relationship to where it is on your body. You know, it's like where your arms are, where your legs are, what goes down first, what doesn't go down first.
Okay, just thought I'd ask about it and see what you thought, so you gave me your opinion, and okay. I still think somehow it's got to work out eventually, but...
Yeah, but no, there's no question that as time goes on, the technology is going to be continuing to evolve and getting involved.
Because I've always thought, like, you know, the yard markers with the sticks and stuff, it's just never really, you know, that accurate. It's like where they place the first stick and the guys come running in and all that. It's just such a waste of time. I know it's exciting because everybody gets worked up about, oh, is it a first down or not? Yay! But it's just, I'd rather just see, boom. It's just read it, have it automatic. Boom, ball crosses. Boom, light goes off. First down, next play. So, okay, well, you have a good weekend, John. Enjoy the pro game tomorrow. And like I said, go Cougs, kick some Stanford butt, burn down some trees.
There you go. That sounds good. Right. Hey, thank you. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Tommy in Des Moines. Hey, Tommy.
Yes, hi, John. This is Tommy. I want to kind of redo this problem happened Thursday night when this referee was fired Friday. Listen, my theory on this is that the coaches should have thrown a flag and challenged it if that was the problem, if that was the key, that's the reason why they fired him. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I mean, really, I don't think you can. Can you do a false start on a challenge? I don't think you can. It's almost like the pass interference. You can't throw up a challenge on a pass interference because, you know, on the false start, because that's one that, you know, I don't think you can. So it's one where you have to keep it in your pocket for the most part.
Oh, wow. That's, by the naked eye, it wasn't a false start.
Mm-hmm. But that's the thing. I mean, it's like if it was or it wasn't, I don't think there's the ability there to be able to make that particular type of challenge, because again, that's one where I think you can't challenge a false start. I mean, that's one. I could be wrong on that, but that's one that I don't think you can do.
Well, I mean, I have to go back to that technology that gentleman just talked about, because they could they really, that technology could really have eliminated that, and plus I disagree with them firing this referee.
Yeah, see, I agree. I'm with you on that. I think that's wrong. I'm 100% with you on that. I think that's a wrong thing. I think it's a bad procedure. I think that if you're gonna do it, you do it in the off season, not in the middle of the season.
That's what I thought, John. And okay, then thank you so much, sir. I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Commando Dave. David, how are you?
Hey, I'm great, John Clayton, because it's always good being on with the professor during football season, especially a week 8 when the Seahawks defense is going to be spinning the hits in Motown like Nowhere to Run and make the Lion Sing Ain't Too Proud to Beg and stop Golden Tate from humming My Girl, or vice versa. And before I bring you to the show, John Clayton, let me give a shout-out to Mariner fans. Go Dodgers! And while I'm giving shout-outs, John Clayton, let me give one to the Sports Bar Network with longtime members like Buckley's in Belltown, who was at the top of Eater.com's list this week of Seattle sports bars with the best football traditions. And if you missed it, there's a link on JohnClaytonGambit.com, along with arguably the funniest John Clayton commercial, definitely the first, way before the one you're known for, and I had to go deep into the archives for Lemon and a Wiener Dog.
There you go.
Still cracks me up every time I watch it. And you know, John Clayton, that commercial proves ESPN was way ahead of the game on what is now a fact of life, getting updates on your phone. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And, no question about it. Yeah.
But I say this, it couldn't get any scarier for Sean Alexander than wondering if you were lurking around his house. And speaking of lurking, John Clayton, we're 65 days away from New Year's Eve. So here's a Halloween question for you. The movie Child's Play came out in 1988, and Charles Lee Ray, a.k.a. the maniacal little doll Chucky, blew up bigger than Lil Penny while Anthony Hardaway was averaging 37 points a game at Treadwell High School in Memphis, Tennessee. And then came Child's Play 2, Child's Play 3, Bride of Chucky, Seed of Chucky, Curse of Chucky, and the sixth, and hopefully last, since they not only ran out of ideas but also titles, was Cult of Chucky Child's Play. But John Clayton, if there was a seventh installment based on John Gruden's return as head coach of the Oakland Raiders, what would be the title of that Chucky movie?
Disaster. Let's see. It would be Destruction.
Chucky 7 Disaster.
Yeah. Chucky 7, the disaster.
Yeah,
they're horrible.
On a side note, John, you know, kidding. On a side note, you know that Chucky was a good guy doll, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And speaking of good guys gone bad, John Clayton, you say the NFL is a quarterback league. So if you were going to start your own team, who would you draft as your franchise quarterback? Michael Myers of Halloween, Jason Voorhees of Friday the 13th, Freddy Krueger of Nightmare on Elm Street fame, or Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Don't you think Freddy Krueger? Because again, it's like he could throw things probably better than the other four.
You might get that deflation.
Yeah, exactly.
Put on also, you never know. Hey, look, John Clayton. I hope Rick in Silver Lake knows I'm just having fun busting his chops about the NFC title game. And last week when I gave him a shout out for being one of the dedicated Seahawks fans who made the London trip, I said, as I just did, Silverdale, got him mixed up with my buddy Steve in Silver Lake. But he did make a compelling point, and you seem to give it weight when you said the home and away designation doesn't matter. Now, remember, I'm a DB, more like an outside linebacker, so I'm not going to let you scoot around the end. London is essentially a neutral site. Like my guy Obi said, if it was truly a home game for the Raiders, they should have put the A's infield in. So if the designation of home and visitor is irrelevant, as you said, isn't it true, John Clayton, that no team would lose a home game in their own stadium if the London game was one of the 8 road games for both teams?
Well, remember, you still have there's 250. There's 128 games, right? And they're not. You can't have 2 road teams. I mean, again, technically they are road teams, but one team has to sacrifice. Or 4 teams if you have 4 international games, because where's that game going to come from? Because you have 16. And so you have Seattle's schedule of 16 games. You have the Raiders' schedule of 16 games. Well, if Seattle's not giving up a home game, they're still having their 8 road games. But one team has to give it up. And that's why, the designation is irrelevant in this. It's a matter of which team is sacrificing a home game where they're supposed to be at home to go over and play in London. In this case, it's Oakland. It's the Chargers. It's the Rams, and now the Jaguars.
You're trying to get around the end, John Clayton.
But that's just reality.
Around the end, it can't be worked out to where both teams, it's a neutral site, but they both have a road game, so no one. You're saying it's impossible then?
No. What I'm saying is you can designate it in the win loss columns, whatever it is. That's irrelevant. But one team has to give up a home game for that to happen, and that's
Why?
The Raiders. Because, you only have 128 of these, and of course they're all scheduled for, 8 and 8, and so one team is giving up a home game. Just simple math.
We're gonna have to try to pick this up at another. I'm gonna have to do some math on this.
Okay, so let's put it this way. Let's say in a normal week you have 16 games, right?
Okay.
You have 8 home and 8 away. So now you are in week 6, and you have the Raiders and you have the Seahawks. Okay, so one of these teams is technically having a home game. Well, the other team is technically going to be on the road. And so you can't just wipe it off and say, because the only way that the Raiders could have 8 home games if they play 17 games, because they're playing their one home game in London.
And lastly, John Clayton, the only band that will be on the field in Berkeley is the Husky Marching Band, stepping on the turf to Ducks, bury the Bears, and go Huskies, go Hawks, go Dodgers. Safe travels, John Clayton. Always good talking
to you. Okay, Commando, thank you. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Joe in Shoreline. Hey, Joe.
Hi, John. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good. Hey, so a question goes back to the technology question on football. This is a baseball technology question. So your thoughts on the home plate umpires having like a Google Glass that will give them a strike zone so they can call the strikes and balls more accurately. And
right.
Do you know, is there any discussion about bringing that kind of technology into the game?
There's discussion on it without question, and it wouldn't be a bad idea to do it in baseball because, again, you have that area that can be defined so much easier. But then the problem is, and this is why it wouldn't happen in baseball, the baseball umpires union is strong. I mean, and so they're not going to allow that to happen. And so where it would be a good idea, because, again, I mean, you can look at the tracer, and when the tracer's there on the TV set, I mean, you can see what calls were right, what calls were wrong. But when you have a strong union like they have, you're not going to be able to implement it unless the umpires want that, and they don't want that because it takes away from what they do and what they can make.
Okay. All right. right. Well, you know, let's hope they get it worked out. And just to you know, for fair and balanced, go Sox.
There you go. That's going to be interesting. We'll see. We'll see how this game three, how both teams recover from it. Because again, there's got to be a definite recovery period. Hey, Joe, thank you for the call.
Thanks, John.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Jeff in Tacoma. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, John.
How are you?
I'm great. It's a great, great Saturday here in Tacoma. Hey, just want to touch base on Doug Baldwin. You know, last mm-hmm. week we saw him come back and back into form, it seemed like, but you know, you're much closer to the action and you know, practice each week, and you know, how do you feel his health is going forward?
Better. I mean, I think that the you know, having the week off probably does help. Now, you know, we'll see. I think you'll see a fresher Doug Baldwin, probably a little bit more involved Doug Baldwin tomorrow. And because again, it's going to be important that when they need to get the passes, he's still their number one guy. So I think that extra week off is definitely going to help him.
Yeah. One other question about the NFC. You know, you look across the board, and other than the LA Rams, there's not too many teams that are actually, you know, standing out. You know, I heard one of the callers just a few calls ago talk about, you know, getting to 10 wins to make the playoffs. You know, perceivably, it looks like there's going to be a lot of 8-8 teams, you know, and mm-hmm. some tiebreakers coming in to figure out who's going to make the playoffs.
Yeah, particularly I think in the NFC, because again, there's such a balance in the NFC, and you're right. I mean, you know, and that's why tomorrow is going to be the interesting test to see, you know, where New Orleans is. New Orleans that second team that can separate from any other team in the NFC, or is it Minnesota? Because I mean, clearly the Rams have the big advantage, and then you look at New England, then you look at Kansas City. And I know some people would put Kansas City over New England, but I still go by the fact that hey, New England played Kansas City and beat Kansas City, so that's where the edge is. But yeah, there's a big separation after that. We'll see if New Orleans is that team that can separate and be the number two team, or is it Minnesota, or is it still to be determined? Because again, I still look at the and I said this at the beginning of the season. I thought it was going to be hard for any team in the NFC to be able to get more than 10 wins because you have so many good quarterbacks. I mean, 14 good quarterbacks, and in the NFC, 14 of the top 20, and they're all going to pound each other week in and week out and make it tough in those conference games to be able to pull a lot of consecutive wins. And that's what's happening so far. So we'll see tomorrow, is New Orleans that other team that can separate, or is it Minnesota?
Exactly. Well, hey, thanks a lot. Have a great football weekend, and appreciate your show.
Hey, thank you so much. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com. Now, more John Clayton.
Our thanks to Matt Nelson for producing the show and also for running the show. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's give you a quick scoreboard update right now as far as what's going on in college football. Clemson's leading Florida State 45-0. Vanderbilt over Arkansas 31-17. These are all fourth quarter. Michigan State 16, Purdue 13. It's Texas Tech trailing Iowa State 31-24. Wake Forest is blowing out Louisville 56-35. Northwestern beating Wisconsin. How about that one? 20th-ranked Wisconsin, 31-10. Northwestern winning that one. UMass over UConn, 22-17. Eastern Michigan losing to Army, 30-14. Akron beating Central Michigan, 17-10. It's Nebraska, 45. Bethune-Cookman, 3. Virginia blowing out North Carolina, 31-14. Charlotte over Southern Mississippi, 14-0. That's in the second quarter. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Greg in Ballard. Hey, Greg.
Hey, good morning, John. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing well.
All right. Yeah, the fog looks like it's finally lifting, and hopefully that's a good sign for the Seahawks tomorrow. That'll be a tough grinder for them. But
yeah, it's not going to be an easy one, no question about it.
I think they can pull it out. But what I wanted to say, you know, talk about, John, is that, you know, I've been watching the playoffs, and I'm just, you know, I'm so frustrated with the Mariners organization and the way that it's been handled. You know, I don't think it's actually so much their fault. I just think it's a little bit of everything. And, I guess I'm just venting now because I realize and I see that the Mariners aren't going to be able to make the playoffs for a long time. And
yeah.
I mean, they don't have a farm league. They're paying over extreme amount of money for underachieved players or players that just don't have it anymore, and they're stuck. And I don't see any way out of this unless they just, you know, try to drop the big contracts as soon as possible and start fresh and get a farm league and go cheap.
You know what the problem? Here's the problem with that. More teams are doing it than when the Astros and Cubs did it, and so because of that, it takes longer now. Because it took the Cubs 5 years, it took the Astros 5 years. Are you willing to concede 5 years of 100 loss, .290s and 100 loss seasons to then not be sure in 5 years that this team can be any good? That's where the problem is. It's much tougher now to get the pitching that you need starting wise. That's why it looked good in the sense that when Jerry DePoto went out and he made the trades that he made, that he's able to get players in their 20s with control on their contracts. You saw that part of the success of this team and also part of the success of the A's is the fact that the American League was so down. I mean, you only had, six teams or so with winning records? And so this team had one of them. But again, the A's just came right out of nowhere with their young talent and then came over. And you're right, that's going to make it that much tougher because you're in a division with the A's, you're in a division with the Astros, and so you're third gun right now. So unless the A's start losing some of their players, then if you're the Mariners, you just got to find some way to sustain it, because if you take that five-year approach, you may not necessarily come out of that with a winning record after 5 years.
Yeah, well, maybe we need to look at what the A's are doing, because they have the least contract value. They're playing they're doing it with guys that are unheard of. Some of them, and it's just, I don't know. I guess I'm just venting, and it's...
Yeah. No, you're right, because, again, this was the knockout punch, I think, this season, because here was a team that, there were 11 games ahead of the A's. Everything looked great for them being able to win and make the playoffs, and then all of a sudden things go south. They get the suspension and with Robinson Cano, and then pitching staff gets injuries, and everything just goes right down the tubes.
Well,
really.
Yeah,
I mean, this one, I think, was the toughest of them all.
Yeah. Absolutely, and that one just... I mean, it buried us, it's just frustrating. But I don't know. I mean, I wanted Milwaukee to go because I always root for the underdog in sports, and that's
right.
I mean, Milwaukee. I wish they could have gotten it, but I got to root for the Dodgers, even though I don't really like LA teams. But I'm tired of Boston teams winning. And
There you go. That's understandable. Hey, thank you for the phone call.
All right. Peace.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Wheat in Tacoma. Hey, Wheat.
Yeah, I'll kick off right on that, John, because I was watching the L.A. crowd there, and I see, I don't want innings and innings and innings, and I see more empty seats and more empty seats, and it's not even that late. And you know what I'm thinking about? Boy, if that was in Safeco Field, this house would be rocking. John, this house would be rocking if the playoffs are here in Safeco. I am telling you, I know we would rock the house, and it kind of bummed me out also, too, man, if I wanted to talk about Mariners baseball, too. But it made me think about, man, if that, because that game went to, 13-15 innings? I don't know, man. I thought it was pretty cool.
18
man,
innings.
You know what I mean?
18 innings.
Well, whatever. I watched it all. I thought it was pretty cool, though, man. I'm like, keep it going. But it just made me think about us here, man. It really did, like that guy said, man. We would have been rocking that house. There'd be no seats. The seats would be full, the whole way.
Agreed.
100%. Anyways, John, and one last thing on Halloween weekend and all that stuff. I got to throw a little curveball at you. What would you be, John, if you were for Halloween? What would you be going out there right now if you were dressed up? What would you be as, if there was an adult party somewhere, what would you dress up as, John?
Yeah. Whew, that's a good one, because I haven't done it since I'm about 8 or 9 years old. So, I don't know. Maybe what I have to do is a professor outfit. Would that work?
No. You got to be something that something that you never would ever be, because something I always wanted to be, a stormtrooper. I always wanted to be a stormtrooper, John.
How about a muscular weightlifter, because that's certainly something that doesn't fit my body. Hey, I've got to run, Wheat. Thanks for the call.
Enjoy
Halloween. And, of course, enjoy tomorrow the game and everything else over the rest of the weekend. I'll be back on Monday at 10. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.